The last word on Today FM with Matt Cooper.
It's time for the last word of the environment, our weekly spot with John Gibbons, who is a member of UNTASHCA, I think it is fair to say, John, isn't it? It's relevant to bring that up because earlier in the week we had a debate between another UNTASHCA member and Fine Gael, or rather two separate conversations, because UNTASHCA didn't want to debate with Fine Gael about this appeal to the High Court finding in favour of planning permission for a new cheese plant in Kilkenny. Lots of farmers got in touch with us during the week. They're livid at the idea that this particular new plant on the Waterford-Kilkenny border might be stopped by UNTASHCA.
Yeah, Matt, as you say, I think it's important to get our vested interests and declarations out of the way. I'm an ordinary member of UNTASHCA. I'm not a spokesperson for the organisation. I was, but I'm not anymore. So just to be clear about that, so I'm a regular member, pay my 50 quid a year, and that's really as far as it goes. So as regards this particular issue, I think it's very unfortunate the way it has been escalated. I think others, particularly from the political class, have gotten involved in really what is a planning issue. And Holly Cairns of the Social Democrats really put this very well yesterday when she pointed out to Micheál Martin that he himself had told her that he wasn't prepared to get involved to speak, that it was inappropriate, shall we say, for elected representatives to opine on planning matters when they're still before the law. So I think there's a little inconsistency, and I think it is also unfortunate, obviously, given his party's history with planning, that I really think it's probably not a great look for Fianna Fáil to be getting involved.
But hold on a second. There have been a number of actions in relation to this. There was a High Court finding. UNTASHCA has given notice of its intention to appeal. Given that the High Court found in favour of this particular project, surely any politician, including the Taoiseach, is entitled to welcome that.
I mean, they can, Matt. He attempted to describe it, I think, one of his colleagues, as a personal matter in the Dáil, but of course there's no such thing as a personal matter. Yeah, I guess it really depends. If we think it's okay for politicians, you know, when legal actions are live before the courts, to opine upon these things, you know, sure. But I'm not so sure about this. I really think we need to butt out. And I would also say that we have to let these things run their course. I mean, for example, a number of years back, when David Norris appealed Ireland's, at the time, criminalisation of homosexuality, the Irish law said that he was wrong. He went all the way, I think, believed to the Supreme Court in Ireland, and he was thrown out time and time again. David Norris ended up, Matt, having to go to the European Court to get justice. And I doubt there's 1% of people listening in Ireland today who think that he did the wrong thing, or that the decision of the Irish courts at the time was correct. So things move on. They have to be challenged. And I think, again, I'm not a lawyer, so I want to be really clear about this. But my understanding is that the reason why UNTASHCA have felt the need to pursue this to the Court of Appeal, which, of course, is open to anybody, farmers and otherwise, is that the High Court ruling appeared to suggest that there isn't really an environmental role in the planning system. Now, that's my understanding as a lay person. And the problem there is that potentially sets a precedent. So my limited understanding is...
Okay, but the argument we heard the other day, John, was that if you're going to supply this major new plant with the milk for making the products out of it, you're going to have an expansion of the dairy herd. And that goes against efforts to try and reduce agricultural emissions or emissions over the next decade or so. But isn't it also the case, as one contributor via Twitter has pointed out in recent hours, that global food consumption is going to soar in the coming decades? One listener estimated 45%. That food is going to include dairy and it's going to include meat. So why the hell shouldn't we be supplying that out of Ireland?
Yeah, I think your contributor is absolutely correct. We're facing the requirement for significant increases in food production, Matt, for human consumption by mid-century needs to go up by 45%. At the moment, most of the world's food isn't produced for human consumption. It's produced to be fed to farmed animals that we then process, either their dairy products or their meat. And in that processing, we're losing between 90 and 95% of the primary energy. So if we plan to safely feed 8 to 10 billion humans on this planet by mid-century, we will not be doing it by feeding them with Irish cheese and powdered milk. And I would add to this, Matt, that a huge output from the Irish, ever-expanding Irish dairy industry at enormous ecological cost here in Ireland is to provide powdered milk to Chinese mums and powdered milk to Saudi Arabian mums. Now, can somebody explain to me why it is that Ireland has a role in providing the Chinese powdered milk market. In what way does that advance food security? And why are taxpayers supporting the provision of cheap raw material to be shipped out by multinational companies halfway across the world to China? I thought we were supposed to be concerned about food miles.
Okay, but what about ensuring feeding people? If they have massively growing populations in China, for example, and they need to feed their children, what's wrong with Ireland doing the business with them and supplying them with the foodstuffs?
I know, but Chinese women come pre-equipped with the ability to feed their own children. And what we're getting is, and what they're getting is, marketing efforts by organisations funded by taxpayers like Boardbia going to countries like China to persuade them to eat more meat, telling them that it's a sophisticated Western thing to do. And also, for example, the marketing of milk products in China by Western agencies has been done, selling it to Chinese people that if you eat and consume milk products, you'll grow taller. And in China, that's considered culturally to be a good thing. So this isn't, Matt, about satisfying an existing need. This is about marketing overproduction in Ireland. And I will say, why are we so overproducing in Ireland? And somebody put this very well recently when they said, virtually all the food in Ireland that we produce, we export, and virtually all the food in Ireland that we eat, we import. So we are a food insecure island. We're thrashing our own island in order to produce vast amounts of food, which we then have to scour the planet to try and find somebody anywhere to buy it from us, rather than instead concentrating on providing for the human food needs. The human food needs are not being met by gross overproduction. Now, I will say, Matt, not everyone is
unhappy
with this.
Hold on, what are people going to eat? If they're not going to eat the protein, as people get wealthier and able to purchase it, they like eating meat and they like dairy products as well that they perhaps weren't able to consume when they were in poverty. So there's a couple of things in that. If they don't eat those, where are they going to get their nutrition? And if they are going to eat those, why should we cut off our noses to spite our faces and not supply them from Ireland and let somebody else do it?
Sure. Okay, we know, for example, that we have to reduce the amount of meat production. I think the estimate from the IPCC and from the Lancet on this is that we need, in the Western world, to reduce our meat production or consumption by about, on average, about 85%. We know we need to do this for climate reasons, because we know that livestock production, meat production and dairy production, is the single biggest driver of global deforestation. The single main reason why we're clearing the rainforest, Matt, is to produce, overproduce meat. And this isn't just production, this is also marketing, distribution and sale. We also have the crazy anomaly where cheap Irish milk has been dumped onto African markets to drive pastoralists who have small production dairy in African countries who have been driven out of business because subsidized Irish dairy milk and dairy milk powder and concentrated milk is being dumped onto their markets. And why would we be dumping milk onto African markets? Are we providing a need? No, we're not. We're actually involved in reverse colonialism, where we're driving the local farmers in African countries out of business to replace them with highly subsidized Irish dairy products. Now, to me, this is not a way to go. We've talked about this before, Matt. Ireland has, for reasons which remain to me a mystery, less than 2% of our land is farmed organically in this country. It's a crazy situation. We're all our biodiversity indicators, as the EPA have told us time and time again, are going down. We've got declines in water quality, declines in air quality. These are all heading in the wrong direction. And the number one culprit of this is the intensification of agriculture. You and I talked about the Birdwatch report recently.
And we won't get into that now because I'm tight on time. And I want to, very briefly, before I move to motor cars, I want to ask you one thing. Would you eat lab-produced meat as a replacement for farmed meat?
In a heartbeat, if you'll pardon the pun. Absolutely. And I've been
processed
up on lab.
From a lab. Really? You'd feel safe with that, would you?
Of course, Matt. I mean, of course, it's far more likely or far less likely to for example, carry infection, because you're talking about a laboratory process. And let's not be squeamish about this. Most of the food that we eat has been at some point in its life cycle through laboratories. So, you know, yogurts and all manner of things are heavily processed in an industrial setting. So I would have no difficulty whatsoever with that. And I mind you, having said that, the real move that we need to, and this really squares the circle of the question that you asked, where are we going, right? There are marketing interests trying to drive meat and dairy consumption upwards because it's in their financial interest. These are usually four of the major world food corporations, and these are large global multinationals. They're the one pushing meat and dairy. What we're pushing against is the need to feed people sustainably, and you do that in a diet that is dominated by vegetables and dominated by plants. It's basically a plant-dominant diet. We have incredible variety in plant-related food. Now, you can, if you wish, if you really miss the taste of a steak, you can, of course, add in laboratory steak if that's your thing. But the bottom line, Matt, is whether we like it or not, we're either, by mid-century, we're either going to feed a horde of livestock or we're going to feed humans safely. We're not going to do both.
Okay, I want to ask you about electric cars, because I believe you think that this may be the year that many will take the plunge and go electric. Really? At the prices of electric cars? At the fact that they are so much more expensive than non-electric cars?
Yeah, Matt, it's one of these kind of tipping points is coming up pretty soon. And what we've looked at, for example, in the first quarter of this year, about 11% of the cars sold in Ireland are battery electric. That means pure electric, none of your self-charging hybrid stuff. These are actual electric cars. Now, that means basically 1 in 10. Now, that is extraordinary compared to where we were maybe 2 or 3 years ago, where we're looking at less than 1%. So it is growing exponentially. Now, as you say, at the moment, there are two real barriers to this. Number one, of course, is the price. And number two has been the range issue. The range issue is being resolved.
And let's not talk about the range. Let's talk about price. Okay. Because yesterday, the Financial Times had a Future of the Car Summit. And at it, the chief executive of Stellantis, which is the world's fourth largest car maker. It has the likes of Fiat Chrysler and Peugeot in its portfolio. Its chief executive said that the requirements for car makers to sell large numbers of electric vehicles during this decade risks pushing personal vehicles out of the reach of current owners because they're simply too expensive. He says, how do we protect the freedom of mobility to the middle classes that may not be able to afford to buy €35,000 battery electric vehicles, where today for the same conventional product, they pay half for it?
Yeah. And in the same article, the same guy said that the probability of his company reducing costs and maintaining margins on electric vehicles by 2025 was significant. So essentially what he's engaged
that in doesn't here it, that is doesn't your, address the issue that that might mean that he might be making his margins on a much smaller sale of number of cars and that lots of people effectively find themselves priced off the road.
Okay, well, let's look at the pricing, Matt, since you brought it up, right? At the moment, and I'm going to have to use UK figures here because that's all we have to hand on this. At the moment, your average EV in the UK is selling at about €33,000 versus €18,500 for an internal combustion. So that's a significant premium. By 2030, according to calculations done by Bloomberg and UBS, the EV in the UK before taxes will be 16,000 and its internal combustion equivalent will be 20,000. That's this decade. Their cars, that's how fast this is changing. Now, you may ask, well, how can this be happening so fast and so miraculously? The bottom line here is the most expensive component by far of an electric car, of course, is the battery pack. Battery packs are predicted to fall in price by 58% from 2020 to 2030. The problem here
Sorry, how can you trust that? How can you believe projections for things like that? And seriously, John, when you see likes of oil and various other natural resources, you get these projections made. The reality is often something very different. And just take as well from the same Future of the Car Summit yesterday, the boss of Glencore, one of the biggest miners in the world, pointed out that the Chinese are cornering the market in the cobalt that's needed for making the batteries of these electric cars. So what you're going to get a situation is that the European and American manufacturers of the cars are running the risk of not being able to get the batteries out of China that they need because the Chinese will make the cars themselves and they'll charge more.
Well, I think if the Chinese, if that's their plan, I think they're out of luck. Tesla has announced a couple of months ago that they're going to make EV batteries over the next year or two without cobalt, replacing cobalt entirely. And the reason
Bitcoin, is it?
Funny you should say that, because Elon Musk yesterday reversed his ridiculous decision.
Oh, I know. We've spoken already to Ian Guider about that, so we won't repeat that. But I still think you may be a little bit, because you want electric cars to succeed, that you may be overly optimistic about the economics and finances for them.
Matt, let me come back to your second point, and that was, how can we trust this arc of cost reduction, right? How we can trust it is, if you and I were having a conversation right now about the cost of a solar panel in 2010 and per kilowatt produced versus 2020, the factor by which it has improved in that period is more than tenfold. In other words, the cost of a kilowatt hour of solar electricity has come down by a factor of 10 in 10 years. And the reason for this is much the same reason why we now have a whole slew of coronavirus vaccines, if I can mix my metaphors. Why? Because there is massive global focus on it. Since really only in the last decade have the big companies started getting the finger out and getting serious about the transition to renewable. And once they do that, these companies, these global companies, once they stop mucking about, they're incredibly efficient at actually turning this around. So I can say to you that that prediction, by the way, of $58 reduction per kilowatt hour, we know, for example, that at below $100 per kilowatt hour, internal or battery packs are compatible cost-wise with internal combustion. Yet we're predicting by 2030 that the battery pack will be below $60,
okay,
right, per kilowatt hour. And as I say, Matt, the thing with this is these trajectories have worked really well over the last 10 years. This isn't...
John,
this
we're
isn't
out of
like,
time.
Like, sure, Matt, but it's not like trying to guess what Saudi Arabia will charge for oil. That's politics. This is technology.
John Gibbons, as ever, great talking to you. We'll talk to you again next Thursday.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper. Listen live, on air, from 4:30 weekdays on Today FM.